Hello and welcome in.
Science. Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Hello and welcome to Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. The night sky has been fascinating and befuddling people for centuries. Just what is out there in the inky blackness, and can there be anything darker than that? My guest today is Roberto Trotta, who's been pondering this question for quite some time. Roberto is an astrophysicist who specializes in researching dark matter and dark energy, two of the least understood aspects of our modern theories of cosmology, and one of the great unsolved mysteries of the universe. Welcome, Roberto.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
It's good to have you on. And as we're going to be talking about things that are dark, I came to thinking about riddles in the dark from Tolkien's classic, The Hobbit. So our riddle this week is more of a traditional riddle, which Miriam is going to give us. What do we have today, Miriam?
Hello, Science Mixers. So today's Science Mixtape riddle is: voiceless it cries, wingless flutters, toothless bites, mouthless mutters, what am I? So I'm going to repeat that one more time. Voiceless it cries, wingless flutters, toothless bites, mouthless mutters, what am I? So if you think you know the answer to this riddle then that we're describing, then tweet us at Science Mixtape. We'd love to know what you think.
Yeah, do get in touch if you know what the answer is. But just to kick us off, let's have your first song, Roberto. This is Ride of the Valkyries. Why did you choose this?
Well, this song really takes me back to my days as an undergraduate physics student in Zurich. I'm from Switzerland and I studied at ETH Zurich. And during exam season, actually, that's the song that I used to put on to pump me up before going into an exam. I had a flatmate at the time who was an accomplished violinist, apart from being a physicist as well. And he would actually rehearse this song on his violin. It was part of an orchestra that played that song at the time. So, and I found it so exciting, and it gave you that amount of charge going into an exam. It really takes me back many, many years.
So here it is, and this version is by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra.
In the clear night, her dark hair mirrors the stars. Blue worlds going around, points of light.
So we'll find out what that's all about later. But firstly, Roberto, your work focuses on dark matter and dark energy. For those people who aren't familiar with these concepts, what are they?
Which is pretty much everybody, because we, the scientists who are trying to figure out, are also very much unfamiliar with them, despite the fact that we've been studying this stuff for 100 years. And in fact, one of the most astonishing discoveries of modern cosmology, the study of the universe, is that everything that we see in the sky, be it with the naked eye or with our most powerful telescopes like the Hubble Space Telescope, everything that's out there that we can see is actually a tiny little fraction of everything there is. In fact, only about 5% of the universe, as we know it, shines, emits light in any kind of form. And that leaves 95% of the universe, almost the totality of the universe, completely dark, completely mysterious, and as of yet, unknown, undiscovered. And so dark energy, dark matter, together, they make up 95% of the universe. We don't know exactly what they are, but clearly they are so important to the fundamental nature of the universe that we must find out. So really, our quest is to find out what is the dark matter of the universe that keeps the universe together, what is the dark energy of the universe that's trying to make it actually break apart in some sense. And it's an astonishing fact that we still don't know pretty much anything about either of them.
So, and they're two kind of different concepts, right? What do we think of as dark matter? What's our kind of best conception of it? I know we don't know what it is, but what do we think?
Well, we have theories, of course. We have ideas that we're trying to prove or disprove with experiment. And so about dark matter, what we do know is that it makes up about 25% of the universe. So a big chunk of the universe, a quarter of the universe is made of dark matter. And we think it might be a new type of particle, a particle like other particles that we know about, but in many ways different in a fundamental respect. It doesn't interact with light. It doesn't emit. It doesn't absorb light. It sits there in the cosmos, and it keeps the cosmos together by virtue of its gravity. It's a massive particle, a particle which is heavy, hundreds of times heavier than a proton, which is one of the particles that make up the atom. And it sits there, and it generates gravity, and that's how we have hints of its existence, by looking at how it actually makes other objects like stars and galaxies move in the cosmos. So we know something's out there, but it doesn't emit light, it doesn't absorb light, so we haven't seen it, but we have indirectly glimpsed it through the effect that it has on other things by pulling them around.
So it's stuff. It's stuff that's out there, but we're not really sure what the stuff is.
Exactly. And it's out there. It's in here as well, because although we cannot really feel the presence of dark matter in any way yet, any given second, about 12 million dark matter particles go through your hand, even here on Earth, and yet we have no inkling of their existence. So we obviously need to strive to get a handle on this.
Yeah, and so dark matter is stuff, but dark energy is a bit different. It's not really the same thing. How is that different?
It's very different, and it doesn't help that we've given them kind of the same name. So it's confusing. Dark energy is even more of the stuff that's out there. 70% of the universe, we think, is made of dark energy, and it's fundamentally different from anything else we know in the universe. And what it's doing, its hallmark signature, is that it's actually not trying to keep the universe together, but it's got a repulsive effect. So we think of dark energy as some sort of anti-gravity that permeates the entire universe, and it's making the universe expand faster with time, which is something that no known form of energy or matter can do. So dark energy is some sort of exotic something that permeates the entirety of the universe that is really pushing it apart. And so it's the majority of the energy of the universe today, 70%. And we know very little about it, except the fact that it's out there.
Yes, that's really interesting. Dark matter is kind of subject to gravity. It's holding stuff together. And dark energy is kind of doing the opposite. It's burning things apart. How can you see the existence of, for example, dark matter? Is that by looking at that gravitational interaction?
That's right. That's right. Right now, the many, many hints that we have of the existence of dark matter, they all rely on the fact that it's got gravity. And therefore, it shows up by changing the way stars and galaxies move around in the universe. So by tracking those movements, we can tell there is something else there that's attractive, that's gravitationally bound or within those objects. And so we can tell there's something there that the telescopes cannot really see. So that's dark matter.
These are stars orbiting around something, and you can, from looking at the orbit, you can see how big it is. But when you look at it in terms of the light that's emitting, there must be something else there, and that other thing is dark matter.
Well, what you describe here is the way we look for black holes, for example, which are not necessarily made only of dark matter. But the principle for dark matter is the same. We see, for example, the way galaxies spin on their axis to be different from what you'd expect them to do if they were only made of stars and the visible stuff that's out there. We see them spinning faster than they should, and they should actually be flying apart if it wasn't for the gravitational effect of extra stuff, the dark matter that's invisible, that's holding them together.
Right, so that's amazing. And is there anything, so we think that the dark matter obeys this gravitational, what do we know about the form of dark energy? Does it follow any equations that we know of? Or?
Yes, we think it does follow equations that were first introduced by Einstein himself 70 years ago, a tweak in his fundamental equations of general relativity, the theory of how gravity works that Einstein invented in 1916. So he introduced something that he called a cosmological constant, a new number, a new constant of nature that might describe dark energy today. However, it then changed his mind. In the 1930s, Einstein took this cosmological constant out of the equations because he thought that, after all, it wasn't necessary. After Hubble discovered the expansion of the universe, the cosmological constant fell out of fashion.
He called it his biggest mistake, I think.
He did, reputedly so in the 50s. So he took it out. But eventually, in the 90s, new discoveries made by astronomers about how the universe expands actually showed, and were awarded a Nobel Prize for it, that the universe is not only expanding, which we knew from Hubble, but it's actually growing faster with time. So it's accelerating in its expansion, which is something that only Einstein's cosmological constant can do. So Einstein was vindicated after all. And so we know there must be something out there that we call dark energy or cosmological constant. It might be a property of vacuum, of empty space itself, in fact, something to do with the nature of empty space, whose fundamental nature, however, we don't quite understand yet.
Okay, well, thank you for that brief overview. I think we're going to have a little musical interlude. The next song you've chosen is Glory Days by Bruce Springsteen. Why did you pick this one?
Oh, that's a song that was being played a lot while I was young in the 80s. It's a song which is by a great singer and songwriter. I love Bruce Springsteen. And it's a song, again, full of energy that really takes me back to my youth.
Behind the stars, space-time grows silent. Hot kisses leave light very tired.
Was that mysterious poem again? But so, Roberto, we had a little brief introduction to what dark matter and dark energy is. What is the evidence that we have for the existence directly? What kind of measurements are we making, and what kind of things are we actually saying to say that this stuff exists?
That's a very good question, because extraordinary claims of this kind do need extraordinary amount of evidence. After all, to say that 95% of the universe is invisible, it's quite bold. But, you know, we don't make those claims lightly. So I can say we have lots and lots of evidence both for dark matter and for dark energy. Dark matter, like I said before, changes the way things move in the sky. And that's been established for many, many years. But equally, we can look back almost at the very beginning of time. We can look back with our telescopes to a primordial epoch when the universe was very small and very much simpler than it is today, and take a picture of the baby universe as it was 380,000 years after the Big Bang. So that's about 13.7 billion years ago. And we can see this with telescopes and satellites.
This is just by looking at things that are so far away that the light left those objects back when the universe was much younger.
Absolutely. And at that point in time, the universe didn't have stars, didn't have galaxies, didn't have planets. All there was a soup of light and what we call a plasma, essentially atoms that were very hot and moving around very quickly. So we can take a snapshot of the universe back then and then compare how the universe looks like today. And the difference is, of course, astonishing. But what we learn from this exercise is that what makes galaxies grow in the universe is gravity. Gravity assembles the galaxies from the primordial initial state. And that gravity couldn't work fast enough to produce the galaxies that we see today in the time that it's got since the Big Bang, unless there is some extra source of gravity, unless dark matter is out there and makes those galaxies grow in time. So the fact that we see galaxies in the sky indirectly is a very good indication that something has made them grow as fast as this, and that something is dark matter.
So, but you're looking at the history of how the universe has evolved, and this dark energy dark matter. See, I'm getting confused.
I know.
Calling these two things the same thing, dark matter must be there. And so do we have the same kind of telltale evidence in the evolution of the universe for dark energy as well?
A little bit less so. Dark energy is a little more difficult to pin down, because insofar as we can tell, dark energy is smooth in the universe. So it's the same everywhere. It doesn't form structures. It's just a smooth thing that fills the universe. And it also becomes important in the history of the universe only relatively recently in the history of the universe. We're talking about 4 to 5 billion years ago. So that's recent in terms of the universe's history.
Yeah.
But the way we can tell is because we can look at distant explosion of stars that we call supernovae, and they're like signposts, like luminous signposts, and they tell us how far away things are in the universe. And we look at them, and we can tell how much the universe has expanded since that light left those explosion of stars, and therefore we can tell what happened to the universe since then. And what we find is that the size of the universe has grown, and it has grown more than it should have if dark energy wasn't around. So dark energy really shows itself by pushing distant stars and galaxies further away from us than they ought to be. And this is the way we tell that something is happening, something is stretching the universe apart in front of our very eyes.
So, I mean, coming to these conclusions means that there's quite a lot of, you have to sift through quite a lot of data. People have been looking at the heavens for, you know, many thousands of years, and they've only got to these conclusions relatively recently. And this is because the universe is so big and you're looking in lots and lots of places. You need to do quite a lot of analysis of lots of data. Are there any kind of particular tools that you need in order to sift all the data to find these very small differences and this very, you know, very minute description of how the universe evolved?
It's a rather complex and sophisticated analysis problem, you're right. And the digital revolution in the last 2 decades or so really means that the amount of data we now have about the universe is incredible, and it's ever growing. So the pace of discovery is accelerating because the pace of data collection, telescopes, digital cameras, and so on, computers, is really going much faster now. But it also means the downside of this is that astronomy, astrophysics, cosmology are now intrinsically big data problems. We've got, you know, a large amount of information about the universe, and our ability to understand, decrypt the fundamental nature of the cosmos is no longer limited by how much information, how many data we have about the universe, is limited by our ability to interpret, analyze, and understand them. So that calls for very advanced statistical methods and ways of actually slicing the data and interrogating the data in a very sophisticated way that's essentially based on applications of advanced statistical methods and numerical capabilities on supercomputers, for example.
And this is mainly what you've been focusing on using these very advanced statistical tools and techniques to analyze this wealth of data. But it turns out it doesn't just apply to astrophysics. You're using these tools that you've developed to apply to other problems. What kind of problems are they?
That's right. And it's quite surprising that actually the kind of statistical techniques that we use to answer complex questions about the nature of the universe can actually be brought to bear on problems that are much closer to home. And so in the last few years, what I've been doing has been to work with businesses and companies to apply some of those techniques to societal problems, be it trying to identify bank fraud from on your credit card, or trying to reduce gas leakage from the distribution network, or else trying to understand and predict the traffic flows in big cities. All of these problems, while being very disparate and very different from astronomy, actually, if you look closely enough and you strip away all the unnecessary details, fundamentally they have data problems, questions whose structure is very similar to the kind of very advanced, complicated problems we deal in astronomy on a daily basis. And so mutuating some of the tools, cutting-edge tools that we have developed specifically for research in astrophysics, and then employing them on these societal and business problems has been a very good way of actually showing that fundamental research of the kind that I'm interested in is actually beneficial to society in a much more direct way than just, of course, you know, curiosity-driven. That's important. That's why we do it. But equally, the spin-out advances that we can get can be really, really useful even on a short timescale.
Yeah, I agree. And I mean, there are definitely people who say, oh, why are you doing this, you know, blue sky research? It doesn't really have any applications. But this is an example of some really direct applications that come from some quite advanced and conceptually difficult problems. Brilliant. Let's have your third song. You've chosen Lady Gaga, The Edge of Glory. Any particular reason?
The Edge of Glory is one of the songs that was playing repeatedly on my iPod as I went out for a number of long runs when I was training for a marathon in Santa Barbara a few years back. And so that's a song that whenever I hear it, I just want to get up and start running because it was playing in my ears constantly, and it really, really gets me going. And it's associated with this beautiful place on the West Coast in California.
Take me home tonight.
Her pink lips stay dry in the heavy dark rain. A soft song might tell you dark stories.
So, Miriam, you've been reading out some poetry that is written in some very simple words. And this is because, as well as a researcher, you're also an author, Roberto, and you've written an astronomy book that's a little bit different from normal popular science. Would you like to describe what makes it unique?
Well, I don't know about unique, but certainly a bit different. Like you say, this book I wrote a few years back, a couple of years back, called The Edge of the Sky. And the idea being that cosmology, astronomy, astrophysics, all the questions we've been talking about are very important. But oftentimes people are switched off. They don't want to hear about this because it's all full of jargon and complicated terms. And I wanted to get rid of all of it. I wanted to write a book that would be understandable by everybody and would talk about the big questions in astrophysics and cosmology today. So The Edge of the Sky attempts to do that by using a little trick, namely using only the simplest 1,000 words in English. And so universe is not one of them.
Right. So what did you use instead?
The all there is.
Okay. I'm curious, did you use all 1,000?
Oh, no, just 707, so there's plenty left.
Oh, right, yeah. There's loads of space there to describe everything else. And so you've written up, and as a scientist, I think it's a bit restricting, is it not, to just use the 1,000 most common words. We use a lot of words as a scientist. Did you find it difficult to write, just using that restricted vocabulary?
Very, very difficult. Incredibly difficult. Much more challenging than I thought it would be. But I found something else as well. The fact that, you know, getting rid of all the words that we commonly use, like electron or star. No, star is in there, but planet is not in there. Galaxy is not in there. Earth, universe, scientist. All these words are not in the list of the simplest 1,000 words, most common 1,000 words. Getting rid of all of them did something extraordinary to the language of the book. At least that's how I felt. It made it simpler, hopefully accessible, but equally it forced me to express complicated ideas in very simple terms that turned out to be, in a sense, quite poetic. So it became much more of a fairy tale story, which is, however, of course, steeped in science, because all that is in the book is a direct translation in this simple language of the things that we are researching nowadays in cosmology. But in a way that hopefully will speak to people's heart, not just to their minds. And so it tries really to bridge this gap between questions that concern us all and the fact that people don't need to have a degree in astrophysics or a PhD to understand the basic ideas behind those concepts, which are so important. Everybody should partake in them.
Yeah, and at the beginning of the book, you had a description of what you do in those words. Could we hear a little bit of that now?
Sure. I'm a doctor at a college where we help students to understand how the world works. People call me a doctor, but please don't come to me with your broken arm or a bad cold. I'm not that kind of doctor. My college is in one of the most busy and beautiful cities in the world, which has a water road running through it, and guards in red jackets and black head covers. The head of state is a dear old lady who comes from a line that once had great power, and people in the street wave when they see her at their window. I ask questions about how everything around us works and why it is the way it appears to be. I also love to talk to people who have a different job from mine, and often they have great questions to which I don't have any answers. I have written this book to tell you some of the things we have learned and the many things we still don't know.
I mean, that's great. It has this kind of poetic take on it. And Miriam and I both work in science, and so we decided to try and restrict our language and give it a go to describe how we do. So now we're going to have a go. Miriam, do you want to kick us off? How did you go?
Okay, so this is my attempt. So I am a student woman and I work on making large hot matter in a box with no air. This large hot matter is just like what the sun is made of, and I try to understand what happens around baby stars. We make baby suns in my workplace on the ground floor of my building, which is so cool. From my work, we can learn more about the all there is.
That's the all there is.
Wonderful.
All right, so here's my go. For my job, I try to learn about the world of the very small. I look at how very small bits of stuff change when light falls on them. It turns out that the way stuff is put together is almost as important as what the stuff is made from when light falls on it. Because this, if we are very careful about the way we put our little things together, we can change the way it works when light falls on it. This will help us to build new things that can make new kinds of light. I am trying to make a thing that makes light that is made up of little balls and not like normal light at all. These little balls can do funny things like be in two places at once, and maybe one day will help us to work out problems that even with the best machines, we can't work out right now.
What did you think, Roberto?
This is wonderful. That's absolutely fantastic.
We tried our best.
It is amazing. It makes you think about the problem in a different way. Do you think that scientists should really think about this more and try and restrict their jargon use when they talk to, even people outside their specialism, because science, has become so specialized that even when people are talking to people who are in the same field but maybe don't study the same thing, they still use jargon words that can't understand. Do you think the onus is on scientists to do that?
Absolutely, both in terms of getting a more inclusive type of public engagement, of course, when talking to other stakeholders, to the general public, but also to funding bodies, for example, that's very, very important. But also to foster cross-disciplinary work. Jargon is important if you're talking to your colleagues who are very highly specialized, just like you are, just a shortcut and just to be precise and clear about what you're talking about. This is really, really important. But if you step outside of your field, even just a little, chances are that people outside your field won't understand you or misunderstand you, which is even worse. So it's really important that people are, first of all, made aware of the amount of jargon they use and how it can impact actually on their ability to communicate clearly and to be effective in what they say and how they talk to a larger number of people than just their strictest colleagues.
Yeah. So let's have your fourth song. We've moved on to Beethoven's String Quartet Number 4, Opus 18. Any particular reason for this little number?
Well, that's a piece of music that's very close to my heart in many ways, but also in a sense it connects to the beauty of physics, in that the particular structure of this music and the way that it's put together with beautiful symmetries reminds me of the way symmetry and beauty play a great part in physics itself. So the quest for beauty, for simplicity, for symmetries, for balance is what drives fundamental physics, just like it drives beautiful pieces of music, just like this.
With their last breath, a blushing of light, from faraway stars, a silent end, times of light half remembered.
Science news.
News.
Record entanglement of 16 million atoms.
First results from Jupiter probe.
New magnets made stronger with less material.
Stray supermassive black hole flung away by gravitational waves.
Ooh, I'm interested in that one. Let's stick with the universe theme and go for the supermassive black hole. What's happening here?
Okay, so gravitational waves are ripples in space-time, and they're said to have flung a supermassive black hole out of the centre of its home galaxy. So this black hole had a mass that's a billion times the mass of the Sun and was in a galaxy 8 billion light-years away from us. So it's about 35,000 light-years from the galaxy centre, and it's travelling at 2,000 kilometres per second. So Marco and his colleagues from the Space Telescope Science Institute in Maryland spotted this rogue black hole using the Hubble Space Telescope. So they think that gravitational waves have caused this black hole to move away from the centre of its galaxy. So gravitational waves are created when two galaxies merge and their central black holes fall towards each other. And as they orbit one another, they emanate ripples in space-time, and these are called gravitational waves. So this was actually the first time that they've observed a supermassive black hole like this. And we have no evidence that supermassive black holes merge in our universe. So this could be the very first piece of evidence to suggest that supermassive black holes can actually merge, which I think is really, really cool. And the energy that's needed to kick out a supermassive black hole is equivalent to 100 million supernovae exploding simultaneously. Oh my God.
So that's quite a lot. That's, that's an inconceivable
number. A lot of
energy.
So,
I mean, these gravitational waves were only discovered quite recently. They've been thought about for quite a long time. So it's amazing that even now we're looking at things that were only very recently discovered are the cause of stuff like this. This is amazing. I found this thing about entangling of a record number of atoms. And so the work that I do is on very similar stuff to this. So I found this quite interesting. What's happened is a team at the University of Geneva have generated this entangled state, which is distributed across 16 million atoms. And entanglement is a consequence of quantum mechanical description of matter. And it was described by Einstein of spooky action at a distance. And it's what it is one atom can be seen to affect another, even though they're separated by a large distance. And what the group managed to do is in an yttrium orthosilicate glass that had been doped with neodymium atoms, the neodymium atoms generate this large entangled state by being prepared with a laser. And this is quite exciting because this kind of large entangled state can be useful for quantum memories. And this is the idea of trying to store a quantum mechanical state in matter. And this is useful for things like quantum computation and quantum communication. These states, which can give us new ways of doing computations, are very fragile. And we need to come up with ways to keep them from interacting with their environment. And it's these kind of large entangled states in quantum memories that can actually end up doing that. So this is kind of fascinating. And Miriam, you also had another thing on the Jupiter probe, right?
Yeah. So last week, delegates at the annual European Geosciences Union met to have a first look at the data from the Juno spacecraft. So it's currently in orbit around Jupiter right now, and they're finding that the data is challenging all the assumptions that we have made from the planet's atmosphere all the way to its interior. So Scott Bolton, the mission principal investigator, actually said that the whole inside of Jupiter is working differently than our models expected, which is kind of cool. The Juno spacecraft was launched back in August of 2011 and began its first orbit of Jupiter as of July last year. So they're discovering stuff like a dense zone of ammonia gas around Jupiter's equator. They've also found that Jupiter doesn't have a uniform interior with a shallow crust of liquid hydrogen, but instead they've discovered that Jupiter's molecular envelope is non-uniform and that the core is not solid but fuzzy and dilutely mingled with the overlying metallic hydrogen layer. On top of that, they've found that Jupiter's huge magnetic field is even stronger and more irregular than we expected, and the infrared images of Jupiter's aurora have revealed to be made mainly of methane and an ion containing three hydrogen atoms. So we're finding so much more cool stuff about Jupiter as we speak, and the Juno cam has taken really, really cool pictures. So I'll tweet out the link so you can see all the cool pictures, and you'll be able to see like cyclones as big as the Earth in the Jupiter's atmosphere. So I'll tweet out that link.
Wow. So we're going to have to move on, I'm afraid, to fit everything in. We're going to move on to song 5, and that's by Jovanotti. And I'm going to attempt to pronounce this title. It's Il Più Grande Spettacolo Dopo il Big Bang.
That's a very good effort.
Yeah. So what's this? Why did you choose this one?
Well, it's got Big Bang in the title. So it translates as the biggest show after the Big Bang. And so there's a clear connection there with my field of study. But that's not the only reason why I chose this song. Because if you listen to the lyrics and you know a little bit of Italian, then you'll find out that the biggest show after the Big Bang is the love of the author, of the singer Jovanotti, for his wife. So it's a song that he dedicated to his wife. It's a very romantic song because, you know, it compares all of these beautiful things in nature, but the bigger thing is you. Essentially, it's this song saying, you know, the bigger thing after the Big Bang is you and us. And that's a song that was playing at the reception at my own wedding. And so it takes me back to a very special moment.
Worlds, all that can be is. Everything opens at the smallest touch of a rose.
Well, so thank you for that poem, Roberto. And earlier you told us that dark matter and dark energy, you told us a little bit about them and why we think they exist. And do you think that there's going to be direct evidence for their existence, maybe, you know, in the recent future, within your lifetime?
Certainly. I think that dark matter might be now on the verge of being discovered properly. Like I said, we've got lots of hints that it's out there, but until we actually can detect it properly and measure it in a laboratory on Earth or get incontrovertible evidence from space of its existence, we won't be satisfied. And I think our technology is evolving at such a pace, and the instruments we have now at our disposal are such that we'll either find it in the next 5 or 10 years, and so therefore within our grasp, or else we might never actually have proper evidence for it, because it probably means that if this next generation, next wave of experiments we are now putting together won't find it, there is nothing that our technology can actually come up with to catch it. And so it's no longer a problem of technology, it's more a problem, or cash. It's not that we don't have enough money to build something big enough, it's just that it's not going to be physically possible to do it. And so that would leave us really high and dry and without a firm answer, which would be very unsatisfactory. So I hope that's not the case.
So let's hope it's the former rather than the latter. We're going to jump back to, we've got our riddle, Miriam. What's the answer?
So let me just remind you what the riddle was. So the riddle was, voiceless it cries, wingless flutters, toothless bites, mouthless mutters, what am I? So the answer to that was actually wind. So voiceless it cries, I think that means that whenever you get like wind through a door or something, it makes the wind slight.
Yeah, toothless bites are cold.
Yeah, this
works. So, Roberto, thank you so much for joining us. And how can people get in touch with you, touch with you, and get hold of your book and sort of thing?
Well, my book is available pretty much everywhere. Certainly on the web, the usual suspects, but in every good bookstore. Otherwise, my website is www.robertotrotta.com. But equally, send me a note with a little blue flying animal. That's how I describe Twitter in the book.
Okay.
r_Trotta.
Brilliant. And you can get in touch with us on @ScienceMixtape on Twitter and Instagram, and search for Science Mixtape on Facebook. If you'd like to listen again, all of our shows are available on Mixcloud, and our podcast will be up on iTunes and all of the other various ways of getting hold of podcasts. We're going to finish up with your last choice, Roberto. Why did you choose Remedy, Little Boots?
Because it's a song that has to do with another aspect of what I'm very passionate about, which is public engagement with science. And I was invited a couple of years ago to go to Mexico with the British Council on an public engagement tour in Guadalajara, where we had a great time. And part of the delegation, cultural delegation from the UK, was Little Boots. And they were putting up a gig, and we were all invited, and we had a fantastic evening with them. This song was playing. They played this song, and the atmosphere was just amazing, the energy, the fun, the evening. And so it's something that really mixes physics, public engagement, great music, all the things that I'm passionate about.
Brilliant. So here's Remedy with Little Boots, and thanks, everyone, and goodbye.